Good morning. As if you couldn't tell what our theme of the week is, we're dwelling with smell. And it's not one of these sins that we bring into church all that often. Incense not being our thing and not being our habit, by and large, we just sort of leave this one off of the worship map. And it's not part of us. But yet we know that smell has a lot of power around us and to us. I invite you to apply the sense of smell as you listen to this text, because it's one of the strongest smelling passages there is. This is John chapter 12, verses 1 through 8. 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany, the home of Lazarus, who he had raised from the dead. There they gave a dinner for him. Martha served, and Lazarus was one of those at table with Jesus. Mary took a pound of costly perfume made of pure nard, anointed Jesus' feet, and wiped them with her hair. The house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. But Judas Iscariot, one of the disciples, the one who was about to betray him, said, "Why was this perfume not sold for 300 denarii and the money given to the poor?" He said this not because he cared for the poor, but because he was a thief. He had the common person used to steal what was put into it. Jesus said, "Leave her alone. She bought it so that she might keep it for the day of my burial. You always have the poor with you, but you do not always have me." Smell is personal. It's a big deal. Not just in the whole, do I smell okay enough to be generally non-offensive sort of pit check concept of the thing, but it's one of the most powerful elements of our senses. Because the right scent can trigger a memory like nothing else. For me, one of these senses is that of strong chlorine, which takes me right back to learning how to swim at the local Y by the, hey, there's the deep end, jump in and let's see what happens sort of method. It's not necessarily a positive memory. The smell of cookies walked into the house might take us to times long ago with friends and family in attendance. The tang of salt in the air might speak of fun at the beach, or the smell of antiseptic can take us into the hospital at moments of great beauty and great pain. Of all the sensory inputs in the world, scent has one of the highest rates of stimulation in terms of brain reaction. So if you look at a pine cone and say, have your brain say, yep, that's a pine cone, and you are given the smell of a pine cone, the brain activity is way higher for the smell of the pine cone than the sight of the pine cone. That's just how our bodies work. I know that there are people who avoid whole ranges of things simply because their smells trigger too strong of a reaction for them, transporting them through time, space, and memory in ways that sights and sounds and feelings simply do not. If you think of a particular poignant moment in your life, chances are that there's probably a smellscape to go with it. All this is true because life fundamentally stinks. On a literal level, where there is life, there is smell. Because there are processes in this reality to it. The world around us is full of scent, and we are keyed into it. Fair or foul, sweet or sinister, our world is shaped largely by the end of our noses. And while there, we may not be as nearly keen smellers as some other animals, we do get a lot of information right there. Emily has told me that ever since the kids have come along, her sense of smell has just gone up here. A bit of a survival skill when you think about it. Kind of a necessary thing. There's also the good old sniff test. When you go to the back of the refrigerator and just open up that thing and just like, okay, where are we on that sour tang, but not quite rotten enough? It was a scale that I used often as a bachelor, I have to admit. And also the role that I still play now, it's just like, hey, Bryce, smell this. Yeah, I'll eat it. But our noses are often our first line of defense, alerting us to the dangers of the world at lightning speed. Like, the Cellini just got sprayed by a skunk. There must be something dangerous out there. That did happen, by the way. And of course, when it all gets too much, there's nothing quite as equal to clear the room like a snoot full of the wrong scent. And most religions, including Christianity, use smell to interact with the gods because the wafting of scent is said to be encouraging to the deity going by. And there's even something to be said in some theories in genetics to say that we are key to people's scent and that our attraction is based as much on what smells good to us as necessarily what looks good to us. But, as I said, when we come to the test, when we come to the Bible, we don't take a great deal of time in reading with our noses on high alert. It's not really our thing. It's hard to imagine the way things smelled way back when, and by and large, it's not something that we apply in our reading process. And besides, do we really even want to imagine that? Because these are the days before regular personal hygiene and, you know, deodorant. It takes some deliberate consideration to know exactly how far one might go in accurately inviting ourselves to smell the smell of Christmas, the smell of the stable, the smell of an overcrowded city full of travelers. There is something to be said for too much incarnation, after all. And things can get messy if we're not careful. But think about it for a moment. How does it change your experience when you read with smell in mind? Does it make it more real, more experiential, more up in your face? How might it change us if we would allow ourselves to imagine the sense of salvation, both the good and the bad? It might take us to some interesting places and some interesting notions. The story of Jesus' feet being anointed appears in all four Gospels, each with its own particular twist on the story. But the action, the place, the timeline, the people, the scenario, all of it changes from gospel to gospel. Although somehow it's always a Mary, but not always the same Mary across the gospels. I chose John's telling of of this story because it speaks most clearly to the smell of the thing. The whole house is full of this perfume, this ointment. And you can imagine that. In all the Gospels, the action and the meaning remain the same. Jesus is honored, death is foreshadowed, and forgiveness is extended. In John's telling, the Mary in question is the Mary of Miriam Martha fame, the one who just received her brother Lazarus back to the dead. And if you remember that story, they say, Jesus, do you really want to do that? The body's been in there for 2.5 days. He's starting to stink. But now here he is at table with Jesus. Perhaps this jar of perfume was intended for the beloved brother that they were going to bury is now being applied to the one who raised Lazarus from the dead and is on his way to his own grave. Tending to this need of the body and to the decay was a very intimate incarnational thing. And it was a rich embrace of what was there. And it was an act that stunned and scandalized the gathered crowd and all of these stories. Here, Judas just happens to be the one who speaks the confusion around us into words. And I dare this say, this might be one of the more Mennonite comments in all the Gospels. Really? You had to use that much? Couldn't it have been sold and given to the poor? Sometimes we miss the point of what's going on right in front of us. And sometimes we're really frustrated by technology. Back in the day, I grew up around... Seriously? I grew up around poultry farmers. And there was a poultry processor about 10 miles down the road in a geography where 10 miles was actually something to talk about. And one of the things that came around with this was simply that when you have poultry farmers in your church, you know what you have to do as a youth fundraiser? You get to catch chickens. Because they would hire out all the local youth groups when the chickens were ready, and we would go in at 4 a.m. and transfer the birds from the cages to the rolling cages on their way to the processing plant. And I never quite understood 4 a.m. because it's impossible to sneak up on several thousand chickens in the middle of the night. The first one you grab kind of gives the game away, and there you have it. And no matter how well you dressed and geared up, it was impossible to come out unscathed, well dusted, and generally bedraggled by the end of the couple hours that we were at it. It was a marvelously dirty, stinky, awful job, but it was good money. We weren't allowed to get in the car with our work clothes on because we stank up the upholstery, and we had to go to the shower immediately upon arriving home. Yet no matter how well you showered, no matter how long you stood under the water, you always had that smell with you for a couple more days after that because you just couldn't get the stink out of your nose. I say all this by way of saying, I think this has a lot to do with the way we work out forgiveness. Most of all, forgiveness with ourselves. The forgiveness that we are most stingy with is that which we extend to ourselves and to our own failings. It's one thing to go out and seek forgiveness to those who we have done wrong. And we should do this. And having achieved forgiveness for others, we are invited to embrace that forgiveness for ourselves too. Yet often we don't. Often one of the things that we carry most closely to us is the sins that we're most ashamed of. The sins that we just can't quite get out of our own noses. It's one thing to accept that someone else has done something, and you might be able to forgive that, but if I know that I have done something bad, I'm likely to carry that for an awfully long time. Because understanding ourselves as forgiven fully and finally takes some doing and proves the most difficult forgiveness to muster. We strongly suspect that there's that in our lives that just doesn't smell right. And it takes a long time to get that scent out of our noses. And when, moreover, we assume that God basically thinks like we do. That God, you know, smells us. And sure, God forgives, but in a mechanistic sort of way. There are words to be said, oaths to be honored, prayers to be made. But when you know that something is really bad or really failing, it still sits with us. And we suspect that God smells it on us. Our expectation is that God feels as bad about ourselves as we do, and we can never quite accept who and what we are. But this is where the downright earthiness of the incarnation is absolutely necessary. From day one, God comes to be with us in the unideal circumstances of our world. And God knows it smells. God comes into the midst of the smelly, overpowering reality of the world and is with us and near us and present to us in the midst of it all. We may well smell of where we have been and what we have done and how all of this has gone. But God, like the Father in the prodigal, embraces us, stink and all, and lets us know that we are forgiven, that we are loved, and most of all, that we are embraced. God does not judge us the way that we judge ourselves. Thanks be to God. This is good news indeed. We are accepted no matter how we smell. Does that mean that we don't need to change or that somehow God's unconditional acceptance lets us continue in our own stink? No, it does not. Forgiveness and embrace of full life are two different tasks and two different things. Just like being forgiven and having consequences to our actions are two different things. We are forgiven, but that doesn't mean there aren't consequences. We all know this in our life, and we certainly know that if we have children. But it doesn't mean that God can be kept out just because we think that the place stinks, that God could never come in and tolerate the smell. God comes in, sits with us as we are, for who we are. The late writer and theologian, Rachel Held Evans, who died over the summer, reflected some time ago on the Sandy Hook shootings, now 7 years ago this week, and far too many similar shootings in the past. And at the time, she was trying to make sense of what do I do with something this horrific. And the season of Advent. And especially when people are said, well, see, all this is because God wasn't there. But she argues the contrary and writes, if the incarnation teaches us anything, it's that God can be found everywhere, in a cattle trough, on a throne, among the poor, with the sick, on a donkey, in a fishing boat, with the donkey, with the prostitute, with the hypocrite, with the forgotten, in the places of power, in the places of oppression, in poverty, in wealth, where God's name is known and where it is unknown, with our friends, with our enemies, in our convictions, in our doubts, in life, in death, at the table, on the cross, and in every kindergarten classroom from Sandy Hook to Shanghai. God cannot be kept out. God cannot be kept out. That's what Emmanuel means. God with us. No matter how stinky it might get along the way, God comes and is with us, around us, and that's to us. We may well freshen up in response to God, but it is never to bring God close. God is already there. Rather, we can respond to God's love and point others to the way of the Lord. We can only do this when we get the smell of our own world and our own self out of our own noses. We are invited to embrace the scent of mercy in each of our lives. My hope for our season is that we might smell the scent of God's grace that overpowers each one this season and every season, and know and tell that the Lord is good.